You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, I've been learning and reading and seeing and hearing a lot about everything from, you know, this really kind of burst into the public view, I think, with the Clive and Bundy thing, although there were the sovereign citizen movement. I mean, the Oath Keepers were hot in the news a year or two ago. The sovereign citizen movement has popped up a number of times from 95, 97, 2003, 2010. A bunch of sovereign citizens shot it out with typically law enforcement officers and killed a bunch of them. But there's like all these different kind of moving pieces to the we're not really quite sure that we trust the federal government dimension of a, I'm not even sure subculture is the right word. I don't mean that in any kind of negative way, in the United States. And so I wanted to get Richard Mack on, Sheriff Richard Mack. He's on the board of directors of oathkeepers.org, isn't it, Sheriff Mack?
I think that's what it is.
Yeah, of the Oath Keepers movement, and former Arizona sheriff in Graham County. You were down there with Clive and Bundy. We talked to you a few times when that happened. And, well, first of all, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me. And I want to reiterate something really quick as far as my introduction. I want everybody to understand that the reason I'm here today, the reason you and I are talking, the reason I'm involved with all this is because when I was sheriff in Arizona, I sued the Clinton administration and won a landmark case at the U.S. Supreme Court on the issue of state sovereignty. And so that's kind of a preface for why I'm anything and involved at all.
Okay, so tell us about that case.
Well, it was pursuant to the Brady Bill, and the Brady Bill was the first time in American history where sheriffs actually stood up and sued the government and won. And this was also the first time in American history where the United States Congress and the President, Clinton in this particular case, told the sheriffs that we are commandeering you for federal bidding, whether you like it or not. We're not allowing you any input, no contractual agreement, no negotiation. You will do this for us because we said so and we passed a law, and so you're going to do it. And they threatened to arrest us if we failed to comply. Let me say that again. The federal government commandeered us for federal bidding under a threat of arrest if we failed to comply. I said, no way. I was the first sheriff to file the lawsuit. Six other sheriffs joined me in the lawsuit, and we won. And we said the federal government has no authority to tell us what to do. They could pass 5,000 laws, and that still doesn't make them our boss. And we should have just said no. Because they're not our boss, whether they make a law that they are or not. They cannot make a law that they are the boss of the sheriffs or other elected officials in any state.
So is your opinion that federal law doesn't, that the job of a sheriff is to enforce, sheriffs are typically county sheriffs, aren't they? Are they not?
Yes.
Okay, so that your job is to enforce the laws of the county, not necessarily the state or the federal laws? Do I get that?
Well, the state, the county makes very few laws. The state really makes most of the laws. And we are sworn, though, we are sworn to uphold and defend the supreme law of the land, which is the Constitution.
Right.
And my case actually even brought that up. What happens to an officer when he has to choose between a very obvious constitutional provision and principle or obey a state statute?
But does not the Constitution specify that Congress makes the laws?
Well, they do at the federal level, but they have only certain jurisdiction. They only have, for instance, the Constitution only allows the federal government 5 law enforcement authorities, and we can list them real quickly.
Sure.
Laws against nations or treaties, any violation of a treaty between us and Mexico, the FBI would investigate. Piracies, treason, counterfeiting, and they are required to protect our borders. Those are the 5 law enforcement authorities constitutionally granted to the federal government.
Where do you find
when
those?
When they go outside that authority, what do? Just go along?
I see some of that in Article 3. Is that where you find that?
It's Article 1, Section 8.
Article 1, Section 8, okay.
Of the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8.
Right.
There are, most of them are in there. Treason is actually in a later section.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they're all counted in there. In fact, the federal government, in Article 1, Section 8, only gets 17 assignments. Their duties are enumerated and discrete, just like my Supreme Court decision said.
Yeah, no, I'm quite familiar with them, but
for the majority.
But, you know, Article 1, sentence 1 of Article 1, Section 8, says the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay
right.
the debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. If you read Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers, where he talks about the general welfare clause of the Constitution, he says, basically, we wrote this as broadly as we could so that future legislatures could determine what the needs of the country were, what the general welfare means. And, you know, he wasn't saying so that a sheriff could determine that.
Yes, he did. Actually, he did. And when it comes to, if you read Jefferson and Madison in response to that, Hamilton really was the most pro and the biggest of the founding fathers in a big central government. He was opposed mostly by Madison and Jefferson and others.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with that.
Hamilton really was a big government guy, but even he would be turning over to his grave if he were able to see what monster we have created in Washington, where they claim control of every natural resource, air, education, health care,
right.
All of that. Hamilton would absolutely be turning over his grave over.
Right. So help me understand this. As a county sheriff, you're saying that you're not bound by federal law, and you're therefore not bound to enforce federal law, and they can't make you enforce federal laws. But you
no,
do.
No, they can't.
But you.
They can't.
If it's constitutional.
Who I work for. The sheriff works for the people in his county under the promise of he will uphold and defend the U.S. Constitution.
Right.
If you read the Constitution specifically, the Hamilton's gesture or suggestion that the General Welfare Clause gives the federal government carte blanche would pretty much negate the rest of the Constitution. The Supreme Court decision in my case states clearly that they were granted only discrete enumerated powers, and such was rendered express by the implementation of the 10th Amendment. So we have to enforce the 10th Amendment. The states and the counties and the people therein enforce the 10th Amendment. The federal government does not enforce state sovereignty. The federal government is always the one destroying it. And so there has to be a healthy balance of power between the states and the federal government. And we do not have that healthy balance of power today. And that's where the states and counties and sheriffs come in to make sure the federal government doesn't cross the boundaries.
Now, when you were at Clive and Bundy's ranch, he asked all the sheriffs of the country to disarm federal officers. And why would he say that?
Well, I think he's seen the militarization of the federal government, where even the Department of Education now has used a SWAT team to go after a man in Stockton, California, because his estranged wife, who didn't even live there, they did a SWAT team raid to collect her unpaid student loan.
Yeah.
That's how ridiculous this has gotten.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but why county sheriffs disarming federal officers?
The federal government?
What provides you with the authority to disarm an FBI agent, for example?
Well, I don't care if an FBI agent is armed, but I do care that BLM and EPA and FDA and Department of Education and so on and so forth, all these other federal agencies that aren't law enforcement, why are they buying up $2.2 billion worth of or 2.2 billion
rounds of ammunition? Yeah. Sheriff Mack, can you stick around with us for a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
We got a few minutes. We're just going to take a real short break here. We'll be back. Hang on just a second. Sheriff Richard Mack on the line with us. Oathkeepers.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And I believe Sheriff Mack, SheriffMack.com as well, his own website. We'll be right back. Sheriff Mack, you still with us?
Yes, sir, Tom.
Welcome back. We've lost a few of our commercial affiliates who are on break right now, but all of our viewers on Free Speech TV and our non-commercial affiliates are with us, which is solidly half our audience, and also, you know, we'll archive this on YouTube.
Okay.
So you were explaining that, you know, and actually I think we can find a lot of areas of agreement where the federal government has just gone way beyond its mandate. I could start with NSA, but, you know, it's but in any case, you were...
My question to you then, and you were kind of asking it the opposite way, my question to you is, when the federal government goes too far, who's supposed to do something about it? The feds? The feds that go too far believe that they're their only check and balance? That is not what the Constitution says.
Well, this is the question that Patrick Henry's father-in-law, and I'm forgetting his name now, but he was the Chief Justice of the Virginia Supreme Court. He wrote a letter to Thomas Jefferson back during Jefferson's presidency after the 1803 Marbury versus Madison decision. And Jefferson was loudly saying, you know, how dare the Supreme Court say that they have the right to strike down laws made by Congress? It's not in the Constitution. In fact, it's a violation of Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. And I believe he was right. And so Justice Roan, my memory is slowly coming back to it, I think it was Spencer Roan was his name, sent Jefferson a letter saying, well, if the Supreme Court doesn't decide what is the law, who does, or what is constitutional, who does? And Jefferson replied to him, the people themselves. He said, I don't trust the institutional power of any branch. And at the time he wrote this letter, he was president of the United States. I don't trust the institutional power of any branch. I trust the people at the ballot box. And so if they believe that the Congress has overreached and passed an unconstitutional law, or if they believe that the president has overreached and engaged in an unconstitutional activity, then I trust that the people themselves will remove these people from office at the next opportunity. And that's why we provided, you know, the House of Representatives to roll over every 2 years and a third of the Senate every 2 years. And, you know, that's so the answer to your question would be at the ballot box.
Well, I think I don't think so. I don't think he said just by voting. I think he said the people themselves. Yes. And working locally to establish the barriers. Madison said we can safely rely on the disposition of state legislatures to erect the barriers against the encroachment of the national authority. That too is in the Federalist.
Well, yeah, and if you look at the context of that conversation, he was talking about
voting.
If you look at the
context, it's not just by voting.
Well, you know, when Madison said that, I mean, go back and read Patrick Henry's, and I think you'll find this fascinating. Read Patrick Henry and George Mason's speeches at the Virginia Ratifying Convention of the Constitution. They both went on at length about how concerned they were that Article 1, Section 8 gave the U.S. government the power to have an army, because they were concerned
And that is another reason that Patrick Henry was the reason why we got the Bill of Rights, because he said he smelled a rat.
It's why we got the Second Amendment. It's why we got the Second Amendment, because he was the largest slaveholder in Virginia, and he said if you get anti-slave people in the government, they will use Article 1, Section 8 to create a federal army that will come into Virginia and disarm us. And that's why the Second Amendment was passed, was to keep the slave patrols. They called them state militias at the time. But
I think it went much deeper than that.
Well, there were multiple dimensions to it, and that was a piece of it. But hang on just a second. We got to take another one of these short breaks. We'll continue the conversation. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the sane among us. We're talking with Sheriff Richard Mack. RichardMack.com is website. He's also on the board of directors of Oath Keepers, oathkeepers.org. Are you part of the sovereign citizens movement? Do you subscribe to notion that
no.
if your name is in
no,
all caps?
No. Not at all.
Okay.
No.
So what separates what your worldview from the worldview of this, it's several hundred thousand people now, of these people, these sovereign citizens, who are refusing to pay federal taxes and who think that the, you know, basically either in the Civil War or in 1933 that our identities got split into a corporation and a real person and all this kind of strange stuff.
Well, you know, I'm not discounting everything they stand for, but I am discounting a lot of their methodologies. And so, you know, the two of us just don't meet because of that.
Right.
You know, one thing that they have a real problem with is asking for permits to do everything we do in our country. And I kind of agree with that. Do we actually have to go ask Mother May I to the government before we can drive our car and use our own property? You know, but those are such mundane, innocuous issues. When we're talking about the real freedom issues and some that we were just discussing, like the right to keep and bear arms, and that the federal government believes it has regulatory authority over these rights that were considered God-given and untouchable. And when we have a federal government that goes to the Bundy Ranch and says, well, you can exercise freedom of speech as long as you do it inside the makeshift corral that we just created and constructed. And if you do freedom of speech outside that, we will arrest you. See, that's the kind of idiocy I'm talking about. And we give the federal government and we give Barack Obama way too much of a pass and an easy go through collecting $200 through the monopoly haze that he has created in this country. We give them far too much of a pass when they destroy liberty that's guaranteed within our Constitution. And I still ask the question, when the federal government does that, who do we have to depend on to erect the barriers against such and tell them, you might do that other places, but you're not doing it in my county?
Yeah, well, and my answer is the ballot box, and your answer is apparently an armed citizenry?
No, I mean, the ballot box, how's that been working for us? Both the Democrats and Republicans have continued the perpetuation of the...
Well, I think it's been a mess. I blame the Supreme Court for that.
They're destroying our Constitution. They're not upholding it. They all promise to, but they don't. Who was there at the Bundy Ranch to try to stop people from being killed? Who was there? Were there any Democrats or Republicans from Washington, D.C.? To try to stop this carnage?
Well, hang on just a second here, just to close this topic out. How is grazing your animals on federal land freedom, you know, and not paying for it, freedom of speech? I mean, if I bought a goat and staked it out across the street here in front of the federal courthouse.
It's the right to the pursuit of happiness, but freedom of speech was being destroyed there by our own government.
How?
I wanted to go there and protest. I protest wherever I want. I can carry a sign, I can carry a megaphone, and say whatever I want. Freedom of speech is wherever my feet are. And the decision about this was already decided in the Hage case when the ranchers in Nye County, Nevada, went through the same thing that the Bundys did. And why is it that we're not asking questions about why our own government is destroying the farms in the San Joaquin Valley in California by turning off the water? Why is it that they're destroying...
Well, I think they're having a drought, aren't they?
You need to go there and look at it yourself. I just came back.
Uh-huh.
And they have destroyed 100,000 jobs. They're destroying farms by turning off the water in the name of environmentalism. They're destroying the ranching industry in the West, including in Clark County, where Mr. Bundy is the 53rd rancher being attacked and destroyed. Everyone else, all 52 other ranchers in Clark County, are gone.
Right. They're moving these guys off federal land.
By the federal government.
Because the land's running out of water.
For anybody to try to look at intricacies about why Bundy shouldn't be there instead of why the federal government is destroying the ranching industry and thus our food supply in this country, then we've got really...
So should anybody be able to just start a ranch on federal land?
Well, they did this way before then, and then we get into the argument, where do they get to own federal land? Why do they get to set up EPA restrictions that fine people $50,000 a day without and act like they're judges?
Well, the why is because Congress passed the law, which is provided for in the Constitution.
Their own problems. And why is it you want to talk about the federal government problems? They can't. The federal government is too monstrous to manage. It's too huge. It's too legion. And then we come up with a problem that has existed for 15, 20 years, and the VA, you know, do we need to say anymore? VA, veterans are dying literally on the streets because of fabricated waiting lists, and we need to wonder what we're doing as a government, and we're going to make excuses. What would be the excuses then? Oh, well, and there's hardly any, but there's still people making excuses and giving this administration a free pass. I didn't like the Bush administration. I don't like this one either. They were both socialistic. They were both unconstitutional. They both accept no responsibility for the problems they create.
But what's the alternative with the VA?
When we have a rancher being destroyed by our own government, we should be asking the federal government a lot bigger questions than why do we have somebody that's been ranching
right. for 50 we just have a minute before we're going to hit a hard break here. I'm sorry.
Okay.
What's the alternative kind of question? I mean, when we had under private health insurance, you had 45,000 Americans dying every year because they didn't have access to health insurance, or because health insurance companies were saying, no, we're not going to pay for you. You have a previous condition, or you forgot to tell us.
Tell me you're not supporting the substitute, the substitute of the federal government coming in and saying, we will now control your life and your...
Well, I'm asking if...
Tell me you're not saying that.
I'm asking if the VA, which is socialist medicine, is not working well, and we tried for-profit medicine, and tens of thousands of Americans died every year. What's the alternative?
The alternative is, first and foremost, my government stay out of my life and leave me alone to my own affairs.
So let us deal with the big corporations.
That's called liberty. That's called liberty.
Okay. I really enjoy these conversations. Sheriff Richard Mack, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Anytime. Thank you.
Good talking with you. SheriffMack.com is website, and he's on the board of Oath Keepers, oathkeepers.org. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's interesting to have an honest glimpse into the worldview of folks like Sheriff. God bless. Occupying the media. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I thought that was a fascinating conversation. I could have done it for an hour or two. I didn't push back an awful lot, because I believe in and trust the intellect and the education of my listeners. And I know that there are some listeners and viewers who agree with Sheriff Mack, and no matter what I say, is not going to change their minds. And probably the majority of listeners and viewers think what he's saying is pretty fringe. But his worldview reflects a very real piece of Americana, of the American electorate. And one of the primary animating forces behind the grassroots Tea Party and the libertarian movement and the Republican Party, or a very small sliver of the Republican Party that Mitch McConnell squashed last night in Kentucky, for example, when he beat Matt Bevins. And I want to continue to have these conversations with him as time goes on about some of these issues, because, I thought it was really interesting, and I didn't want to interrupt him in mid-rant because I thought it was interesting what he was saying, but he said, why do we need driver's licenses? And I'm like, well, what about the public good? I mean, the preamble to the Constitution lays out its mission statement. And you could say, you can talk about enumerated powers all day long. And by the way, Shane looked up Sheriff Mack's Supreme Court case, and he was right. He got 5 votes. Scalia wrote the decision, and they actually said that the federal government can't make sheriffs do things that are just federal laws, basically. They can, sheriffs can refuse to enforce a federal law if they're told to. And Scalia used the enumerated powers argument. So this isn't just some crazy right-wing crackpot perspective. Now, the Sheriff Mack Supreme Court case has never been cited by the court or by anybody else that we can find, but it's there. What year was that, Shana? 1997. That's been a while. But the preamble says, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility is capitalized, to provide for the common defense, that's all in lowercase, to promote the general welfare is capitalized, and secure the blessings of liberty, capital liberty, to ourselves and our capital posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. So if you're going to ensure domestic tranquility and promote the general welfare, and you have people driving in public places 6,000-pound pieces of equipment at 70 miles an hour that are easily capable of killing other people, and they are intoxicated or they are incompetent, how is that not a violation to my right to liberty? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, if you want to go back and kind of meld the Declaration with the Constitution. Now, I didn't want to go down that rabbit hole with him. I would love to in the future sometime. We'll get into that conversation. But what's wrong with we the people collectively saying to and of ourselves, we are deciding that in order to provide for domestic tranquility and the general welfare, we ourselves are going to have standards, whether those standards are the rules by which the Koch brothers oil refineries can or cannot pollute the atmosphere, or whether those standards are, you know, what can be done with the land that we all collectively own. And I frankly never really understood how the relationship between grazing cattle on federal land and free speech. But I think Sheriff Mack was really talking about two separate things. I think he felt that his right to free speech was somehow infringed, presumably by the police showing up and taking Clive and Bundy's cattle off that federal property. But the whole thing I find fascinating. And I've known folks who have this worldview my entire life. My father was not anywhere near this extreme right. He was more of a Goldwater Republican, although he did take me to a John Birch Society meeting once. But I think he did not hold them in the highest of regard. And Eisenhower in 1956 campaigned on a platform of, vote for us because we extended unemployment insurance. We increased Social Security payments and the number of people eligible for it. We strengthened the right to unionize and expanded the number of people in unions. And we raised the minimum wage. I mean, explicitly, that's what Eisenhower campaigned on in 1956. In 1952, he campaigned on peace. His main campaign thing was, vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. And the Korean War, which he did. That Harry Truman War, what my dad would refer to as those Democrat wars. And he meant, Korea and Vietnam. But anyhow, James in Wilmington, Delaware, you wanted to get in and comment on this. Hey, James, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Been listening for a long time. You've given me great information over the years.
Thank you.
Robbie Batra saved me a bunch of money back in 2008. Anyway, on to the sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying that he's got this right to protest anywhere he wants. Tell that to the Occupy protesters in New York City.
Yeah, and that's, again, I almost interrupted him and said, didn't you as a sheriff enforce vagrancy laws? I mean, isn't there a point where free speech becomes vagrancy? And,
yes.
Which were the laws by and large that were used against the occupiers. And so, I think that's a legitimate question. And this is why I enjoy having these conversations and I want to dig deeper into them, because it seems to me that on the right, and I'm not speaking specifically of Sheriff Mack here, and he's not here to defend himself, and I don't want to get into about him specifically, but in general, those talking points are used selectively to condemn the federal government when it comes to Clive and Bundy, for example, and ignored, particularly over on Fox News, when those same rules are used against the Occupy movement, for example. I think you're right, James. Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard.
Oh, hi. Thank God he's not there to defend himself, by the way. I don't think he could.
He's got his worldview, and he's sticking to it. It's pretty coherent.
Well, why doesn't he wait until they investigate it, if the Republicans can have an honest investigation?
Oh, the Veterans Administration?
Ought not to jump. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, these maggots that politicize the issue or Benghazi, no one else calls them what they are, which are maggots. People have gotten, apparently some people have been mistreated by the VA, but now in everybody's mind, the VA is bad, the government's bad. Again, here we go. But
right.
If you look at the VA, they cover a lot of people. You can go into a hospital that's privately owned and get bad treatment too.
No, that was the point that I was making. Is I didn't want to go into a long riff about it, but the fact of the matter is that when you do satisfaction surveys among people who have used different medical systems, VA comes in number one. Actually, TRICARE comes in number one, which includes the VA. VA comes in number two. Medicare comes in number three. Medicaid comes in number four, and private health insurance comes in number five, last.
Yeah. And the next thing to find out about this, too, is, you know, have the Republicans been holding back any funding to make sure that the VA doesn't get...
They have filibustered 13 bills since President Obama was sworn into office in 2009. They have filibustered 13 bills, including one just 3 months ago that was a $30 billion boost to the VA. The Republicans have filibustered every single one of those.
And this is just like Benghazi, where they cut the military protection for these embassies now, and nobody holds them accountable. The media doesn't,
yep.
And these people are zealots, and they are unable to hear anything but what they want to hear.
Well,
and
I think there's a
cancer in this country.
There's an echo chamber in which many of these folks on the right live. You know, they watch Fox News, they listen to conservative talk radio. They read WorldNet daily, and that's their entire universe. And that universe is very supportive of this worldview that we're describing here. Or you know, they go over to Glenn Beck's site or something like that. It's relatively supportive of this idea that the federal government, you know, that really we need to go back to before the Civil War, when the federal government was weak and the states were strong.
Yeah, Tom, is he on the Oath Keepers? As you just said,
he's on the board of directors of the Oath Keepers. Yeah.
Yeah, everybody ought to go to YouTube. There's a 51-minute Oath Keeper video that I watched 20 minutes of. I couldn't go any further, and it had to do with their spat with another bunch of gun-toting, shooting, pointing at federal official machine gun cabinet.
Yeah.
And they got into a fight and they threatened to kill one another. And I never saw a bunch of bigger babies in my life. These tough guys.
Well, I haven't seen it, so I can't comment on it, but I'll have to check it out. Richard, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So I think we can all agree our government's screwed up. I think that it's the Supreme Court saying that money is speech. Everything's gotten corrupted by billionaires. And welcome back. Carrie, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Carrie, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Glad to take my call.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for calling.
The gentleman you were speaking to, the former sheriff,
mm-hmm.
He sounded a lot like from two generations of during the time of the Civil War and then during the time of the, I guess you want to call it, the Civil Rights era, when they were standing in the doorways of most of the places that the federal government was trying to
integrate
folks to get ahead.
Yeah.
So, to me, I'm not trying to say he don't believe in the stuff that he's saying. He definitely believes in what he's saying.
Yeah.
It's just that the stuff that he's saying harmed a lot of folks through the years.
Well,
this
is where Rand Paul came out, and if you can easily find, Shano, the Nixon Kennedy debate from 1960. There's a clip in that where that talks about this. This is where Rand Paul came out and said he would not have voted for the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, because, or at least the Civil Rights Act, because he believes that it's an inappropriate federal interference in the right of a state-based store to discriminate if they choose to or not to discriminate. And if there's going to be anti-discrimination laws, they need to be passed at the state level, not the federal level. You've got it? Do we have 2 minutes to play it? Let me just play this for you, Carrie. This is how the Republicans used to debate this. This is from the 1960 debate between Nixon and Kennedy about integration. How do you deal with this problem after Brown v. Board? Here it is.
I have talked to Negro mothers. I've heard them try to explain how they tell their children how they can go into a store and buy a loaf of bread, but then can't go into that store and sit at the counter and get a Coca-Cola. This is wrong, and we have to do something about it. So under the circumstances, what do? Well, what we do is what the Attorney General of the United States did under the direction of the President. Call in the owners of chain stores and get them to take action.
See, now that was Nixon saying basically we would jawbone these guys. We would talk to them. Kennedy says we're going to kick their ass under the law. Here's Kennedy.
Senator Kennedy.
Well, Mr. Nixon hasn't discussed the two basic questions. What is going to be done and what will be his policy on implementing the Supreme Court decision of 1954? Giving aid to schools technically that are trying to carry out the decision is not the great question. Secondly, what's he going to do to provide fair employment? He's been the head of the Committee on Government Contracts. He's carried out two cases, both in the District of Columbia. He has not indicated his support of an attempt to provide fair employment practices around the country so that everyone can get a job regardless of their race or color. Nor has he indicated that he will support Title III, which would give the Attorney General additional powers to protect constitutional rights. These are the great questions. Equality of education in school. About 2% of our population.
So we can stop right there. You get the idea. So basically, the Republicans have always said, you know, we shouldn't involve ourselves in this. And the Democrat, I mean, since 60. You just heard the debate, Kerry.
I just heard it. I appreciate it. I appreciate you giving up this information because more folks need to be paying the more attention.
I think so. And I think that there are Republicans today. And keep in mind, Richard Nixon was vice president of the United States when he had that debate with Jack Kennedy. He'd been vice president for 8 years. And the Republican Party has just basically always taken that position. And Kerry, thanks a lot for the call. I gotta run. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And just a quick hop in here. Jeff Golden in Ashland, Oregon, is on the line. He's an advisor to the Our Family Farm Coalition. OurFamilyFarm.org, I'm guessing, is the website. It's cut off on my call screener software here. Let me see if I can stretch the page out so I can see these things. OurFamilyFarmsCoalition.org. There we go. So, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Well, hi, Tom. Good talking to you.
So you guys had a victory last night in Oregon?
Yeah, it's a pretty good day for non-corporate types who think that democracy isn't a spectator sport in Southern Oregon.
Tell us what happened in
well, of course, this, we talked a month ago about this. We had a county initiative to ban GMO cultivation altogether in Jackson County after some young organic farmers a couple of years ago discovered that Syngenta had sugar beet plots here that were GMO. Uh-huh. Tried to negotiate with them. Syngenta wasn't interested. Went out and got the signatures easily and got things on the ballot in the Rogue Valley here, this small agricultural valley. And it took a long time to actually come to election. And Syngenta and Monsanto and others, lobbyists in Salem, successfully got a statewide preemption passed that banned counties from regulating GMOs and other ag practices at all. But Jackson County was grandfathered in because we were already on the ballot. Right. And what ensued was sort of a war of the worlds, about $2 million spent on this measure, roughly 3-1 by the no folks, the Monsanto folks, way beyond twice what's ever been spent here before.
Right. And they lost.
There was this constant drumbeat on the media, scare tactics, that same kind that helped them turn around the labeling measures in
right.
California and Washington.
Right. So, Jeff, the net is that you guys won the thing, and now GMOs are banned in Clark County. It's not Clark County.
Jackson.
In Jackson County. Right.
That is correct.
Okay. That is great. Well, hopefully that will spread. That will go viral, and people need to check out OurFamilyFarmsCoalition.org for more information on that.
And I just want to say, Tom, people are taking seriously your reminder at the end of every show. That democracy begins with you. And I really got to shout out the younger people. You know, a lot of us graybeards sort of helped some, but the water was really carried by younger folks who have not been very involved in this before. And now they woke up this morning and said, you know what, we actually are powerful.
Yeah, there you go. Jeff Golden. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for being on the program. And good on you. It's a great victory. I appreciate it. Robert in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Hey, Robert, you wanted to get back to talking about Oath Keepers?
I guess maybe not Oath Keepers specifically, but in general, these guys. It's been a while since I took my comparative governmental studies class,
mm-hmm.
but if you use the triadic model of freedom, you can understand the thought process that goes on there. And I understand because I, you know, we all have some things we don't like to check in with the government about, I guess.
Sure.
I don't know. I haven't had too big of a problem with it yet, but.
Well, I think the war on drugs is an abomination, for example. I feel the way I feel about that, probably the way the sheriff feels about driver's licenses.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you with that, and I think that the driver's license is a little bit smaller than the other prohibition going on. But I think sometimes these guys, I mean, I don't know if they've ever been to a magic show or anything, but it seems like they're really, like, good at sleight of hand, being fooled by sleight of hand and not understanding that they're getting mad at the muscle. Because if you follow the idea that the government is the arm of the corporation is the boss, and they're getting mad at the enforcer or the soldier, and then they just keep voting for the same boss.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and this is the problem. This is where Sheriff Mack and I agree. Our government has been hijacked. The question is by who? You know, he thinks by big government liberals and communists or something like that, and I think it's been hijacked by billionaires, basically, who are getting legislators to do their bidding, and you know, just stirring up the little folk who are being screwed to think that it's the government that's bad, when government is frankly, I mean, you got billionaires with tremendous power. The only force that can hold them at bay is government. It just, you know, I don't disagree, though, that our government needs to be a lot more responsive to the people. The vast majority of the people want Social Security strengthened. And instead, what does the government try to do? Weaken it. The vast majority of the people want Medicare strengthened. The government tries to weaken it. The vast majority of the people want unemployment extended. The government refuses to extend it. Now, this is the Republican Party now. The vast majority of people want the minimum wage raised. The Republicans refuse to raise the minimum wage. I mean, you know, we can go on through the list. The vast majority of people would like single-payer health care. It's not what we get. But I think that that's because the Supreme Court has let the billionaires in the door, starting in 1976 with the Buckley case, and, you know, promoted by Lewis Powell, the author of the famous Powell memo. And David Koch, in fact, in 1980, when he was running for vice president of the United States, pointed to the Powell memo and said, you know, this gives us a loophole that lets us pour money into politics, basically. And a piece about this in the New York Times just this weekend. Robert, thank you for the call. Israel in Lebanon, Missouri. Hey, Israel, thanks for listening to Progressive Voices on TuneIn Radio. What's up?
Hey, man, I'm a huge fan of your show.
Thank you.
I got a solution for these people in Nevada that hate the federal government.
Okay.
Let's shut down Hoover Dam.
Shut down the Hoover Dam, right.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, if you hate that battle, just get rid of it. You know, it seems odd to me. That
is one huge federal project. I've driven over the top of it. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems odd to me that people who are out in the desert kind of depended on, you know, something that was done by the federal government, are so upset with it.
Yeah, we're right next to us. Every day I walk past the federal courthouse, U.S. District Court, I believe it is, the one that, isn't it? Isn't that federal? Oh, it's the First District Court? It's the what? No, the federal building between here and Union Station. The Thurgood Marshall. It's some kind of, anyway, I walk by the federal court building, and it's got a lawn out in front. What if I bought a goat and put him on a stake and said, you know, I'm going to feed my goat here, and when he gets fat enough, I'll sell him, you know, to whoever eats goat meat? Would Sheriff Mack show up and defend my right? I doubt it, but maybe. I don't know. And I shouldn't personalize this to Sheriff Mack. I think this is the Israel, thanks for the call. But there is an issue of water. The West is experiencing a drought. The federal government is, the Bureau of Land Management is charged with managing land, and so they're going into many of these federal lands and saying, you know, you got to get your cows off the land because there's not water here anymore, and they're ruining the land. Yeah, I understand that.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Greg Laurie's on the line with us, a staff attorney for Earth Justice, earthjustice.org. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Greg Laurie. I'm looking at the wrong line on my... Am I pronouncing your name right, Laurie?
Yes.
Okay, L-A-O-R-I-E.
Earth Justice. That wasn't quite right.
That's not correct? Okay, tell me how to spell it.
L-O-A-R-I-E.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's how it's spelled in front of me. I need to get stronger glasses. Anyhow, Greg, Earth Justice, we've been hearing about colony collapse disorder, the loss of the bees here for some time. And I saw an article in one of the science publications yesterday or the day before that there is now really a substantial body of evidence that colony collapse disorder is tied to the nicotinoid, these nicotine-based pesticides, at least in some parts of the world. But and the USDA just came out with a report on the demise of honeybees, and you guys have a report, the case of the vanishing bees. Tell us about this.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. We are at the point of crisis with respect to honeybees. It's really quite unprecedented. Starting in about 2006, we started losing honeybee colonies at rates that we just had never seen before. That year, something like 30 to sometimes 90% of bees just simply died or disappeared, and commercial beekeepers started sounding the alarm. Since 2006, those trends have continued. We continue to lose about a third of our honeybee colonies every year, and it's really a huge issue of concern. And you might wonder, now, why does an environmental group like Earth Justice particularly concerned about the plight of the Eurasian honeybee? And I'll tell you, because the honeybee crisis is a human health crisis. One out of three mouthfuls of food that we eat can be traced back to a honeybee's pollination. And as it turns out, it's the most nutritious of the three mouthfuls. These are the things like nuts and fruits, vegetables, squash, all the stuff that we really ought to be eating. And so this really is a human health crisis of the first order, and sustainable agriculture really is at risk. So as you point out, there's a lot of, as is usually the case when you have a situation that's as dire as this, fingers start pointing in many different directions. And there's no doubt that there are a lot of reasons why honeybees are taking a hit. Yeah. But there's really no question that pesticides are playing a role. And the pesticides in particular, as you mentioned, are the neonicotinoids. And there are several reasons for that. First and foremost is that they are systemic insecticides. And that means that whereas with a normal pesticide you might spray it on the plant and the pest is impacted by the dried spray droplets, that sort of thing, systemic insecticides are actually absorbed into the growing plant itself, and it renders the plant and all of its tissues and pollen and nectar toxic to the bees. So you can really see why this becomes an issue. You've got a field that's treated with systemic insecticides. The bees visit the field.
Doesn't that mean that it's in our food, too?
Well, in some extent it is, absolutely. Now, the reality is that in many respects, neonicotinoids are less toxic to humans and less toxic to
animals. Right, because we smoke nicotine.
Well, that has its own issues.
But
the fact that it might be less toxic to humans, that certainly doesn't mean that it's less toxic to bees. And in fact, these neonics are very toxic to bees.
Right. How do you address the issue that Jared Diamond brought up years ago in, I forget the title of the book, but it was one of his big books, in which he pointed out that in North America we had no honeybees and we had no earthworms, actually. before the arrival of Europeans? That both of these were things that were brought by Europeans. Is it that many of our food crops were also brought from Europe and therefore there's a problem? I mean, is there, or is it that whatever insects used to occupy that ecological niche and pollinate things like nut trees and fruit trees, that they've been displaced or wiped out by either the bees or by these same pesticides? Or, I mean, is there any, if the bees go and we are back to where America was in 1600 or in 1590, is there a way to avoid a disaster scenario, or should we just be doing everything we can to keep the bees?
We need to be doing everything we can to keep the bees. I mean, both of what you alluded to is true, that the agricultural system that we brought over from Europe and the crops that we brought over from Europe, which were cultivated by humans for you know, millennia and evolved alongside humans, those crops depend upon honeybees, the Eurasian honeybee in particular, for pollination. Now, some of the New World crops, you know, there are native...
Corn, for example.
Well, corn actually doesn't rely on insects.
Right, it pollinates by wind.
It is a wind-pollinated crop, which is not to say that corn pollen isn't sometimes sort of used by bees. Bees will sometimes collect it, but the corn doesn't rely on the bees, which is not to say that the bees don't sometimes use the corn.
Right.
In any event, there are other native pollinating insects that can pollinate crops, absolutely. They are less abundant. They are not as easily farmed, really. So when you think about it, the systems that we've built and the agricultural systems that we have created require commercial domesticated pollinator, insect pollinators.
I just got it. I just all of a sudden it made perfect sense for me. Basically, the people who were living here before Europeans showed up were by and large hunter-gatherers. I mean, there were a few agricultural societies, but they weren't widespread, and they didn't use high-tech agriculture like we do. So they had not tamed nature. They had not domesticated nature. And so they didn't need domesticated pollinators. So the wild pollinators were adequate to the wild food that they were eating, and their population was fairly low. It was only a few million people. When Europeans showed up, they had already tamed nature, they had domesticated plants, and they had domesticated the pollinators for those plants alongside those plants, and we are now entirely reliant upon that system that was developed 400 or 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, well, actually, arguably 10,000 years ago with the advent of the agricultural revolution in Europe and in the Middle East.
That's right. Let me give you just one really concrete example. There are estimated about 2.5 million managed domestic honeybee colonies in America. It takes 1.5 million of those, so over half. It takes 1.5 million of those colonies just to pollinate the California almond crop. So every year, 1.5 million honeybee colonies are put on tractor trailers, semi trucks, trucked across the country, and brought into the California Central Valley, where pretty much entirely, that's where all of the country's almonds are grown, just to pollinate that one crop. So it really is something that you can't have the almond industry without a bee.
So if we wanted to go back to the America before the bees, we'd have to go back to the America before the Europeans, which means we'd have to go back, we'd have to drop our population from 300 million and change back down to maybe 10 or 20 million where it probably was at that time.
That's right, or you'd have to accept a diet that consists of corn and soy.
And lots of weeds, you know? and we don't have, you know, buffalo and deer and things anymore, at least not in the percentages that we used to, or fish for that matter, and they're all poisoned with mercury now, and it's like going back just ain't an option is the bottom line. So what do we do? What is Earth Justice doing?
I think that the good news is that this is something that has really resonated. People are understanding the scope of this problem, and I can't tell you how heartened I am to see the response that our organization has had. I can't tell you how happy I am to see the extent to which the public interest organizations have come together on this issue. So a lot is being done. I'm hearing some background music, so I don't know.
Yeah, we got to wrap it up, but people can learn more about this over at earthjustice.org, I'm assuming.
Yes, absolutely.
Get the whole story. Okay, so get thee over to earthjustice.org and check it out. Greg, thanks so much for being with us.
I really appreciate it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We will be right back. You can check it out, as I said, at earthjustice.org. Welcome back. And Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. So much to talk about, so little time.
Really?
But I try to get to the main point. The founding fathers had a problem with the, you know, the rulers of their time. And I guess they thought the best way to get a power to respect power was to get property owners to form some kind of front. I think the 99% could take a page from that book and get the that book, The 40 Million Slaves, get all the workers of property to form some kind of front to get this world right by money-wise and get rid of this non-sustainable economy we have.
Yeah.
We talk about polarization. How can you have one group exploiting another and have a democracy?
No, I'm with you. The way to do that, in my mind, is unions and worker-owned co-ops.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. That's what we need to do. Cooperatives come together to get rid of this privatization. Excuse the destroying the word, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But that, basically, that's what we need to do, because anything else is not going to work.
Yeah, and we've seen this. I mean, you know, unions built a middle class in the United States between 1940 and 1980, and then Ronald Reagan started destroying them. We went from 27% unionization when Reagan came into office to around 7% now, and the result is that the middle class has collapsed. And
yeah, well, the unions, we have to get past demanding more money and start getting ourselves together, because we ain't going to get nothing asking people who control everything for respect. We have to get ourselves together and form up. Walmart workers have to form their own Walmart. KFC have to form their own KFC, just like we formed our own country.
Well, and
we
when
the king for some kind of respect to form our country, you think we, you know, we ain't going to have it.
Yeah.
We got to do our own thing peacefully, you know. And I think most people of right mind would, you know, say, okay, go ahead, do it. I mean, how can you be civilized if you always hear competition, competition? It don't make no sense. Civilized people cooperate.
Yeah.
Democracy is a co-op.
Yeah.
Am I right?
It is. And unions are democratic institutions as well. And this is why when Martin Luther King was shot, he was speaking at a rally, not about civil rights, but about the right to unionize. It was for sanitation workers' right to unionize, because he felt that economic justice and racial justice were intertwined. This was all the same stuff, and not just here, but all around the world.
It's logic. It's Thomas Paine logic. I can't understand progressives. Not they say buy America. We need to buy cooperatives.
Yeah. Yeah.
Worldwide, and then we could have a basis to come together and form some kind of economy to get rid of this kind of cutting down the last tree, poisoning the last lake, whatever, to make a dollar. It's crazy.
Yeah, it is. And it's being run by billionaires and corporate interests, and it's something that, you know, we need to be seriously considering. The cooperative movement is alive and well in the United States. There are more people who work for co-ops than there are people who are members of unions, which is actually kind of a sad commentary on the state of unionization. But it's, you know, it is growing, and it's growing around the world. The Mondragon Cooperative out of Spain is the world's largest, and they're all over the place. So, Jesse, excellent call, excellent point. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back. Tom Harbin here with you, and Gwen in Hartford, Kentucky. You wanted to tell us about something Senator Pat Roberts was going off on the floor of the Congress today?
Yeah, I sure would, Tom. First of all, I'd just like to thank you for your efforts.
Oh, my pleasure.
I don't know if you caught any of it, but Senator Pat Roberts is praising the Koch brothers for all their hundreds of millions of dollars of donations to cancer research and what have you. And I'm just wondering, what's your take on all this?
Well, you know, they have given a lot of money to cancer research. I think it was David Koch had prostate cancer, and after that, he started donating big to, you know, organizations that are looking for a solution to prostate cancer. That's fine. I really don't think, though, that we should live in a society where we have to depend on billionaires to fund our research. This should be a basic function of government. And these guys work as hard as they can to do things like destroy the National Institutes of Health, which has been responsible for most of the cancer breakthroughs that we've seen. You know, it's so. And if Pat Roberts was on the floor of Congress talking about how wonderful the Koch brothers were, you can bet that the Koch brothers have their hands in Senator Pat Roberts' back pocket, Glenn. So
I don't have them in my pocket yet.
Yeah, there you go. I'm sorry, I was looking at the screen and my brain mixed up words there. But Glenn, thank you very much for the call and for the heads up. We're gonna have to. That would be great to get that clip. We're gonna have to see if we can track that one down. Tina in Jay, New York. Hey, Tina, what's on your mind today?
Hi, sir. I have a micro and a macro point, and I don't feel antagonistic toward Sheriff Mack. I get that, you know, live free or die spirit. However, who's going to protect me if a bunch of cattle ranchers come to my land and graze on my land? Do I arm my neighborhood?
Well, I think I can speak on his behalf here, or at least that worldview. Let me not try to speak on behalf of Sheriff Mack, but generally what these folks would say is, if you own your land, that's private land, and it is the job of the county sheriff to protect your local land because there are local land use laws or local land ownership laws. But, you know, what they object to is one of the things they object to, apparently, is the federal government claiming that it owns land in the states.
I understand that, but ownership is ownership, is it not? And taxes are part of civilization, just like cooperation is.
I agree.
That's the micro point. That's the micro point.
Sure.
The macro point, and it's not a conspiracy theory. I think it was an afterthought to the billionaires and corporate powers that be who have bought our elected officials to a large extent, that as they took away thinking from education and made it rote learning, as they took away respect of being a worker in America and lowered wages and made it more and more difficult to achieve the American dream, as they did this and watched us get angry, as they hyped up that Second Amendment, arm yourself, you've got the right, I think they sat back and said, they're just going to kill themselves. They'll be so hungry and angry and desperate, they'll just kill themselves and our work is done because they are untouchable. By the armed people in Nevada, by the armed people in Pennsylvania, the billionaires are untouchable. And I think the joke is on us, because when the citizenry and the Congress goes after each other, the billionaires aren't coming to their rescue. You know, the billionaires may invite a congressman to dinner, but it's probably to serve the meal, not to sit down and eat it.
Yeah, there you go. Yes, I think it's a good point. And here's the problem, is that this used to be illegal. I mean, I wish I had at my fingertips this old Wisconsin law, but there was this old Wisconsin law that said that it was in every state in the union, actually. I mean, Wisconsin just by some accident was the last state to ban it, to do away with it. And that was 1954, I think. Jane Ann Morris tracked this thing down and shared it with all of us. I've got it in my book on equal protection, in fact. And in fact, maybe I can grab it right behind me. And read it to you, because it's just such. I mean, these kind of laws we used to have. UVW here. Where is Wisconsin? Here, I'm looking in my table of contents. Well, these are the laws that we used to have. In the here we are, 97.312. Let's see if it's on page 97. It is. No corporation doing business in this state shall pay or contribute or offer consent or agree to pay or contribute directly or indirectly any money, property, free service of its officers or employees, or thing of value to any political party, organization, committee, or individual for any political purpose whatsoever, or for the purpose of influencing legislation of any kind, or to promote or defeat the candidacy of any person for nomination, appointment, or election to any political office. Penalty. Any officer, employee, agent, attorney, or other representative of a corporation, that would include lobbyists, obviously, acting for and in behalf of such corporation who shall violate this act, shall be punished upon conviction by a fine of not less than $100 nor more than $5,000. Now, back in the 19th century, that was like, you know, 5 years' salary. or by imprisonment in the state prison for a period of not less than 1 year, nor more than 5 years, or by both such fine and imprisonment in the discretion of the judge before whom such conviction is had, and if the corporation shall be subject to a penalty, then by forfeiture and double the amount of the fine, and if a domestic corporation, in other words, a state-chartered corporation, it may be dissolved. And if a foreign or non-resident corporation, in other words, an out-of-state corporation or a non-U.S. corporation, its right to do business in this state may be declared forfeited. That's what we used to say. The Supreme Court said you can't say that anymore to the states. And this is why we need to amend the Constitution to stop the Supreme Court, which is why I tell everybody, go to Move to Amend. Make sense, Tina?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for giving me an opportunity to share with you my favorite piece of legislation that comes out of the history of the United States. We need to be able to pass laws like that again. I mean, McCain-Feingold had a little tiny slice of that, right? You can only give a certain amount of money, $2,200, to candidates for office. And the Supreme Court struck that down. He struck down McCain-Feingold. That was the whole point of Citizens United, was striking down McCain-Feingold. And the Tillman Act, it passed in 1907. Citizens United struck down the Tillman Act, you know, it's which said same similar thing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Republican President Teddy Roosevelt got the Tillman Act pushed through in 1907, and it said if you give money, if a corporation gives money to a federal candidate, the corporation goes to prison, the officers. The good, the bad, and the very, very hammer roaster at the ugly, the good. Pope Francis I. While speaking in Rome today, the Pope urged his audience to be stewards of the earth. He said, quote, creation is not a property which we can rule over at will, or even less is the property of only a few. Creation is a gift. It is a wonderful gift that God has given us so that we care for it and we use it for the benefit of all. Always with great respect and gratitude, end quote. Francis's comments come just weeks after the Vatican hosted a summit on sustainability and appear to be referring to climate change. I hope those Republicans who call themselves Christians are listening to what the Pope is saying. The bad. Pat Sajak. Unfortunately, not everyone can be as wise and insightful as the Pope. Sajak, the host of the game show Wheel of Fortune, caused an uproar yesterday when he blasted people who care about climate change on Twitter. He said, I now believe global warming alarmists are unpatriotic racists knowingly misleading for their own ends. Good night. I'm not going to even bother trying to understand what Sajak was trying to get at there. Some things are probably just better left unsolved. And the very, very ugly A.J. Delgado. The National Review writer brought sexism to a new height in his latest column, which is titled Crying Rape. According to Delgado, the surge in sexual assault cases on college campuses is best explained by the fact that, quote, women themselves are being taught to believe they were raped. That's right. A.J. Delgado thinks rape is all in the head of those crazy women folk. That is very, very odd. That's incredibly, I mean, that's mind-bogglingly ugly. Michael, in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
How you doing, Mr. Hartman? I want to sort of get sarcastic with you about Greg Lowry, and I want to tie that to religion.
Okay.
Colony collapse disorder.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Question. When you were a kid, had you heard of or attended any CCD classes?
CCD.
It was Catholic. I forget what the acronym stands for, but it was a Catholic thing. When I was a kid, I went, you know, and you go to CCD classes. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I didn't go to Catholic school, and I was raised Protestant, so no, I've never heard of it.
Okay. All right, then I'll just forget. So isn't it ironic that colony collapse disorder, which is what Greg Lowry was talking about, CCD, which could be a premier problem for our agricultural world, has the same potential to hurt humanity as the way religions way back when.
Oh, is CCD an acronym for something that happens within the Catholic Church or a doctrine or a class or something?
It's like, when kids go. Like,
so it's like a doctrine class, Catholic catechism doctrine or something like that?
I'm sure Shano or Danielle can look it up on the internet. But, yeah, when we were kids, we went to CCD. You know, we did the walk when Jesus was crucified, blah, blah, blah. You know, we were little kids.
Yeah.
But, yeah, isn't it funny, though, how, I mean, colony collapse.
It's called Conference of Christian. Say that again. Confraternity on Christian Doctrine.
Okay. I was born Roman Catholic, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just amazing how CCD, Colony Collapse Disorder, has the same initials as, you know, the way we indoctrinate kids.
Well, and but then on the flip side of that, you got the Pope coming out today saying, you know, we have to defend all creation, which includes the environment. It's the world. We've got it. You know, so I think it's a good thing. That's very interesting, Michael. But yeah, it's an ironic name. Thanks a lot for the call. Richard in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I was calling about the bee issue too. And
okay.
I've heard Michigan has passed a law similar to one I believe is in New York, about being 250 feet from a residential area or more to raise bees and chickens. And I've been trying to find out information on it, and I can't find it anywhere. And I was kind of hoping maybe one of your listeners would have some ears on and come up with a heads up so we know what's going on here. Because I don't know if it's an actual if it's in a city limits or if it's out, you know, and like I live in a township.
Right.
And I know there's people. I've got a lot of friends that raise bees and chickens together and are very close to neighbors.
Right. What did you say, Shane?
So
it's in Ypsilanti.
It's only in Ypsilanti?
It's a beekeeping ordinance. Shane found one for Ypsilanti. I would guess that there are probably beekeeping ordinances for a lot of cities that, you know, specify, you know, and I know I've lived in Louise's. This is one of the weird things about her. We've been married all these years. She's always wanted chickens. And when we had when we ran the community for abused kids, we had chickens, and Louise was just in heaven. But I put my foot down, you know. It's like, you know, no, we're living in Portland, Oregon, or we're living in Atlanta, Georgia, and she's like, wherever we live, wherever we go to, she's looking up the rules. Can you have chickens in this town? And it turned out that there were a couple of towns that we've lived in. I don't remember if it was Montpelier or Portland. I know in Portland, I think you can, where you can have chickens and roosters and in your backyard. And I'm just like, you know, ain't gonna happen. I mean, there are, you know, there are very few things that Louise and I disagree on, but that was one of them. And
I tell you, everything's so expensive.
But I can, what I can tell you that I would guess that, you know, they're typically regulated as a public nuisance, and probably bees would be regulated the same way because you don't want, you know, your next door neighbor to have bees if you've got little kids, for example. And so that's probably what you're talking about, Richard. And I would guess that that happens at the city by city level or township by township, maybe county by county. BeeSource.com, Shano says, is the website for all the laws and all the information. Richard, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Roger, listening on KTNF in Lake Forest, Minnesota. What's up, Roger?
I had something I couldn't understand ever since that Citizens United thing. I'm kind of wondering, because the Constitution, the 10th Amendment, limits the power of the federal government, and the fact that the word corporations doesn't appear in the Constitution, and as a fact, a creation of a state, it seems to me it would be up to the states to define who they are and what they are, and I'm not sure why the Supreme Court is defining it. I was wondering if you know anything about that.
I agree with you, and I raised this topic kind of parenthetically. It's only probably four or five paragraphs in my book on equal protection, which is the book about, you know, how corporations became people. It starts out in 1803 and takes us all the way up to, actually it starts out with the British East India Company and takes us up to today. It starts in 1601, and we just updated it to include Citizens United and everything. And one of the points that I made in there is that the Constitution corporation does not appear in it, but the Constitution does allow Congress to create certain types of institutions, and there are some federally chartered corporations. They're few and far between. The Fed is one, for example. It's federally chartered. It was created by virtue of the federal government. And there And I'm not sure if there are any federally chartered for-profit corporations. I think that they're probably all not-for-profit. So if you really wanted to be a Scalia-like originalist constitutionalist, then you could argue that the Supreme Court could have, and you believed in judicial review, which I don't, but nonetheless, let's say you did, that the Supreme Court actually has the power to make law and break law and destroy law, then you could argue that the Supreme Court could rule on the constitutionality of a federally chartered corporation like the Fed, but they can't rule on the constitutionality or the constitutional behavior or the regulation, the ability of government, local or state, to regulate corporations that are chartered within the states, because 99.9999999% of all corporations in America are created at the state level, and roughly half of all the corporations in America, certainly more than half of all the corporations on the New York Stock Exchange, are chartered in one state, in Delaware, which has the least restrictive corporate laws. You can start a corporation with one person on the board, one person as an incorporator. You can have a single sentence as your statement of purpose. This corporation is chartered to do anything that's legal in the state of Delaware, and the reporting requirements are very minimal, and the requirement to the fees are very, very low. In most states, it's $300-$500 to create a corporation in Delaware. I think it's like $75 or $100, or at least it used to be. The last time I started a Delaware corporation was probably a decade and a half ago. It used to be fairly cheap. But I think that the argument that you raise, while it's nuanced and it's subtle, it's an important argument, and I'd love to see it argued before the Supreme Court. Roger, thank you for the call. Pete in Lake Zurich, Illinois. Got a minute to the break. Pete, what's up?
Well, I'll make it really quick, then. I'll give you a quick synopsis. I just ran into something this past week which kind of ticked me off. I didn't know about it. The average homeowner in my community pays about $10,000 to $12,000 a year in real estate taxes.
Right.
So I tracked down what a golf course pays, and I found out that our local golf course, which is privately owned, for-profit, members only, has 47 acres and pays $5,000 a year in real estate taxes.
How did they do that?
That's not an example of the average homeowner subsidizing the rich. I don't know what is.
Yeah, I agree. I'll bet that there are two corporations. One's a not-for-profit corporation, which owns all the land, and the other's a for-profit corporation, which owns the clubhouse and runs the club, and they lease the land from the not-for-profit corporation, which doesn't pay real estate taxes. I'd bet $50 that's how they're doing it, although I don't know. But unless you know. Do you know how they're doing it, Pete?
Yes, I do.
Oh.
What they've done, they separated the clubhouse and the open land, the golf course.
Right.
And then they apply for an open land exemption, which is legal because you're not developing the land.
Okay, so they use that loophole. Very interesting. Pete, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, we had a variation on that in Vermont. At one point in time, Louise and I owned 400 acres of forest land in Vermont, and as long as we kept it as forest land, our taxes were a quarter of what they normally would be. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Steve, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network in Rochester, New York. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
You were talking to that sheriff about the veterans, and you were trying to get him to say, what can we do to help about the veterans situation? And he refused to answer it, I think. Well, there's a way of solving that veterans problem. It's simple. If they would just give us a little chit so I could go to the best hospital in the whole state of New York, it's right around the corner from me. I spent 2.5 years in a VA hospital when I come home from World War II and got the best treatment in the world. And it was great. Over the years, I've seen it become a mess.
Yeah.
If they just give me, I won't bother them. Just give me a jet. Let me go from my service-connected stuff to the hospital.
If now, does that
with every service-connected veteran?
Sure. I'm assuming your local hospital takes Medicare and Medicaid patients.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's
okay. So they could simply take the VA and say, and this is something that was suggested to Bernie Sanders last week, and he's chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee, and as I recall, he suggested that he thought it was a good idea. I don't want to put words in his mouth, and I hope I'm right on this.
I'd like to see it get pushed because it's just plain makes. I won't go near them anymore. And, luckily, I have a good home and a good wife and good kids. But, you know, I'm lucky. I'm lucky I'm alive.
Yeah, we all are, actually.
In 1946.
Yeah.
Okay?
Amazing, amazing. Well, Steve, thank you for sharing your story and for calling into the program and for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. I'm with you. I think that, I mean, you know, George Bush not only declared war on two countries, one of which had nothing to do with 9/11 and never declared war on us, and the other country had, as a country, nothing to do with 9/11. They had some, you know, Bin Laden living there, but that was it. George Bush declared war on two countries, committed hundreds of thousands of American troops to battle, which, as a consequence of that, we have probably over 100,000 wounded veterans, certainly over 30,000 severely wounded veterans, and thousands of dead veterans. But, you know, looking at the VA system, not only did he not provide for an expansion of the Veterans Administration system or a cleanup of the Veterans Administration to get ready for all these people to come up. I mean, just like, you know, him and Rumsfeld sent all these guys off to war without even putting armor on their Humvees, without even giving them body armor. We had private charities buying body armor for soldiers. Remember that, 2003? I mean, it was just, you know, they were running ads on TV next to Sally Struthers saying, please save the poor starving children in Africa. And some other, you know, Hollywood actress saying, oh, please save the poor dogs, you know, in the shelters. And then there was somebody else going, please save the veterans. They need armor. You know, it's like, really? This is how we treat our vets? Or our soldiers, our active duty soldiers? We go on television and we beg for, and now they're doing it for the veterans. Have you seen the TV ads? You can commit $15 a month for the rest of your life to save a veteran. Wait a minute. That's the job of the government. But George Bush not only sent those guys into war, he shut down VA facilities all over this country, particularly in rural areas. Because, hey, if you can break the government and then you can say, look, the government's broken. We don't need no stinking government. Let's let the Koch brothers do it for us. Or let's let Stephen J. Hemsley from the United Healthcare do it for us. Or let's let Kaiser Permanente do it for us. If you can figure out a way that somebody can make a buck off it, that's the Republican way. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And Jim in Vida, Montana. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
I got two quick things, Tom. I heard a report today in California, the shale oil. It was estimated that California had two-thirds of the country's shale oil.
Yes.
And that would be the...
That can be fracked out. Yeah.
Right.
Like they're doing in South Dakota.
Right. A report came out today that it's unrecoverable with today's techniques, and that combined with the threat of earthquakes, it's not going to happen in the foreseeable future.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a big effort in California to actually legally ban it statewide.
Right.
I know that there are some municipalities and counties that have already banned it.
Right. So that's good.
Yep.
Now, I wish that would happen in North Dakota, which I'm close to here. But and the other thing is we've actually got a progressive running for U.S. Senate in Montana.
Tell me about
To fill Max Baucus's seat. He's real good on just about every issue you can think of. He actually came out against Keystone XL, which as far as I know, he's the only Western politician that's against it.
So what's this guy's name?
His name is Kirk Adams, and you want a website?
That's fine, but before you give it to me, has he gone through a primary yet?
No, that's coming up.
Okay, and is the Democratic establishment supporting him, or is he the dark horse candidate, as it were?
He's a dark horse candidate, and he's running against a John Walsh, who's to the right of David Duke. He's anti-choice, pro-KX. You know, pro Keystone.
Right.
But
he's a Democrat.
He's horrible. He's
He's a Montana Democrat. Okay, I got it. So
right,
what's the progressive's name and website again?
Okay, it's Dirk Adams. He's a rancher from Wilsaw, Montana.
Right.
And his website is www.adamsformontana.com.
Okay, Adams, A-D-A-M-S, is the four F-O-R?
Right.
Okay, adamsformontana.com. Got it.
Right.
Jim, thanks a lot. Hopefully a few people will check that out and toss some support his way. Bob in Sacramento, assuming that what you said is true. Bob in Sacramento, California. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hi.
Nice to talk to you again. I wanted to say something about what Sheriff Max said about his law case, and you said something, it wasn't fringe because the Supreme Court did decide it, but if Scalia wrote the decision and it was the Rehnquist court, it is by definition fringe right wing.
You're right. You know, I stand corrected.
Rehnquist installed George Bush illegally. So if that's not fringe right wing, I don't know what is. Second thing, again, Sheriff Mack brought up the VA and how horrible it is. Well, I just enrolled in VA healthcare about a month and a half ago. And in my intake, they did an EKG, found an anomaly. My doctor ordered a stress test. Within a few weeks, I had the stress test. The stress test was done on last Friday. By Sunday, my primary care doctor at the VA called me up and told me to gut my ass into the emergency room right away. They are scheduling an angiogram for me on Thursday, and they will immediately thereafter either install a stent if necessary, and if truly necessary, they will do bypass surgery on me right away.
Holy cow.
Immediately.
And in the meantime, avoid all sugar and any animal products if you possibly can.
Yeah, I pretty much already am doing that mostly. I eat a lot of fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, that's good.
As it is, you know.
That's good.
But these people at the VA are great.
Yeah.
They do a great job, and I wish everybody in America had the quality of health care that I've experienced with the VA.
Yeah, the challenge is just the getting into it. It's this waiting list thing, and that has to do with them, you know, getting computerized and getting up to speed. And I, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if there's some private corporation in the middle of that one. But anyhow, Bob, thanks for sharing the story with us. I appreciate it. And for defending the VA. Government does do some things right. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? Good afternoon, Tom. I'm looking at you on Free Speech TV.
Thank you, Charles.
I just wanted to say that, first of all, it's upsetting that the Republicans are making a big deal out of this, I guess, wannabe scandal with the VA. If these things did happen, you know, one thing about this president that I noticed, you know, that George Bush wouldn't do, everyone has made a mistake on his cabinet or in his administration, he usually gets rid of them, even if we like these people or not, you know.
Yeah.
And that shows great leadership as well. You know, the thing is with George Bush, though, under his administration, I'm pretty sure that I can't remember that there was at least a couple of bills that the Democrats did push forward to try to help the Veterans Administration and the VA hospitals, and the Republicans turned it down.
I can tell you there's been about a dozen of them since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated, that many of them passed. Actually, the Senate never, you know, died in the House. Others were filibustered in the Senate. The programs specifically to help veterans. And, you know, the Republicans are all about creating as much pain as possible, whether it's with working people or with veterans, and then hoping that, you know, pain gets blamed on average working people. Charles, thanks so much for being with us. Janice in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Janice, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to say my VA in the Jacksonville-Gainesville area is great. I love my socialized medicine, so I guess this issue is on a case-by-case basis. But I love my VA, and we've had no problems.
Great. Well, thank you for sharing that with us.
I can't say no problems, but my experiences have been good.
Yeah, and that's typically what veterans say once they get into the system, is that it's one of the best healthcare systems in the country. It is our socialized medicine system. And then people who aren't in the VA but use our single-payer healthcare system, Medicare, or our low-income single-payer system, Medicaid, that has the second highest level of satisfaction. And then down at the bottom, of course, is the private health insurance companies and what they have to offer and the hospitals associated with that. Janice, thanks a lot for the call and for your kind words about the VA. Up next, Michael Leidy, the Progressive Democrats of America, and the National Nurses Union is going to drop by and tell us. They just had a progressive roundtable today, and we're gonna find out all about that. We'll continue the conversation about everything from Sheriff Mack to the VA. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And in the studio, live with me, is Michael Lightly. He's a spokesperson and associate. I don't know what your title is with PDA, with Progressive Democrats of America, and with the National Nurses Union.
That's right. Now, people want to take me lightly, but it's actually Lighty.
Lighty. Thank you very much. Yes.
But yes, no, I am on the PDA Advisory Board, and I'm the Public Policy Director for National Nurses United.
Great. So you guys had a progressive roundtable today. Tell me what happened.
Well, it was amazing, Tom, because it started with Jim McGovern, who was scheduled to speak, the congressman, right, who said, hey, I got to rush. We got to fight over an amendment that I want to introduce to the NDAA on saying, okay, we're going to withdraw troops from Afghanistan by 2014. Let's put it in law. And the administration and the Republicans pushed back. The Republicans said to Congressman McGovern, oh, we don't want to embarrass the president.
Doesn't pass the law. I've got a bridge to sell you. Yeah,
exactly.
The Republicans don't want to embarrass the military contractors who are making a fortune there and channeling their profits to the Republican Party. But why didn't the president want this thing to happen?
Well, now that's a good question.
I'm guessing that the argument that the White House would make is that we want to have the flexibility to deal with the situation on the ground.
Yes, that's right.
And actually, you could probably build a fairly rational case for that.
You could, the military prerogative. On the other hand, it is stated policy.
Yeah.
And it
was a stupid invasion to begin with.
Exactly. So it should have been over a long time ago or not happened at all.
Right.
So it should go into law. That's how we started. Then Congressman Keith Ellison from Minnesota came and talked about the Robin Hood tax, H.R. 1579, talked about the work around minimum wage and the fight against the TPP.
Right.
And really just it was extraordinary because it was the bringing together just what we want, the movement and the congressional representatives fighting on the issues that matter to working people. And so between those two, we were off and running.
Wow. That's great. So and then, you know, what came out of this?
Well, we've got an extensive program. We had 200 congressional offices visited today by PDA members dropping letters on these issues.
All around the country.
All around the country.
Local offices.
Okay. At the district level.
Right.
So they were promoting, opposing the fast track authority.
Mm-hmm.
They were weighing in on NDAA. And they were supporting H.R. 1579 and also calling for single payer because tomorrow is a big national lobby day for single payer.
Right.
So it was PDA activists on key issues, educating Congress.
Tell me about the National Lobbying Day on Single Payer.
Well, this is an event with Physicians for National Health Program, Healthcare Now, of course, National Nurses United, Labor Campaign for Single Payer, All Unions Committee for Single Payer, with Public Citizen doing a lot of the legwork.
Wow.
And we're going to visit senators and congressional offices in support of Bernie Sanders' S-1782, H.R. 676 from Congressman
Conyers. This is basically national single payer, everybody into Medicare.
Everybody in, nobody out, Medicare for all, improved so that it really delivers on the promise of guaranteed health care.
Right. What's the mechanism for transition? It always seemed to me that you've got to ramp up a bureaucracy, whether you're a health insurance company or whether you're the federal government. And it always seemed to me that if we were going to move everybody into Medicare, we should probably do it a decade per year. In other words, for every year that passes, the eligibility age for Medicare drops by 10 years. And, mm-hmm. and if you could, or something like that. Right. I mean, is there any kind of mechanism built into either of these laws, or does it simply say Congress shall come up with a mechanism, or you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it is.
I don't want anybody to be left out.
Right, exactly. Hand. Well, you know, it's an interesting question because if you go back to the history of Medicare when it started, that enrollment period was seamless. They put every senior in Medicare within a matter of months.
Really?
It's totally unlike healthcare.gov.
Of course, the Republicans were support. Well, and no, the Republicans were opposed
to it.
Then, yeah.
But the enrollment was easy. And so we do believe it could be easy again to enroll everyone.
Yeah.
On the other hand, as a matter of you know, political strategy, there's certainly a case to be made. Let's give it to people 55 and over.
Right.
Let's give it to people up to 26, and then let's eventually get, you know, the rest. And right. that was actually envisioned by Ted Kennedy and John Dingell. They had a bill that would have done exactly that over a period of years.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Back in the day, was that when Ted Kennedy was going up against Jimmy Carter in the primary? Was it around that?
No, era? It was actually at the beginning of the ACA debate when Senator Kennedy was still alive.
Oh, that's
that was his proposal with John Dingell.
Well, and you know, and he got a big fight with Richard Nixon in 73, I think it was.
Yeah.
Nixon's proposal was basically Obamacare.
That's right.
And Ted Kennedy said, that's not good enough. We got a single payer. And he blew it up.
That's right.
He blew it up. But I think he regretted that for a long time because it was a start. You know, it was a camel's nose under the tent. So Progressive Democrats of America, Tim Carpenter has passed away. God rest him. And we were all together in Massachusetts the weekend before last, if I'm recalling correctly.
That's right.
To say goodbye and also for some really good political stuff and a lot of great people. Bernie Sanders was there, great stuff going on. PDA is moving on. This is what Tim would want, of course, and PDA is continuing. PDAmerica.org is the website, Progressive Democrats of America. What, beyond just the Progressive Roundtable you had today, what all is our, I'm not sure which, anyway, is or are, what's the what's PDA up to?
Right.
Well, it's been a long day.
Indeed, that's right. Educate Congress.
Right.
You know, monthly letter drops in congressional district offices.
Right.
Obviously, the roundtable. There's been a lot of interest in urging Senator Sanders to run for president as a Democrat. And the belief is that PDA can play an instrumental role alongside that campaign to make sure it's not only about the candidate and his ideas, but it's about building that movement to demand fundamental change.
Now, I was Friday night, the weekend before last, Bernie was there Friday night and he gave a talk.
Right.
And I was doing a TV show here, and so I was on an airplane flying. I got up there at like at midnight or something. So I missed that. Was he at any point directly asked or confronted, or I thought you guys were going to deliver 10,000 petitions to him.
Oh, that happened.
Okay. And and what was his response?
Noncommittal, but the crowd erupted. I mean, it was standing ovation. You know, when I think it was closer to 11,000 signatures at that point. We're continuing that. And then we ended the meeting, not ended the meeting, but at some point in the afternoon, we declared a unanimous consent to urge Senator Sanders to run for president as a Democrat, and this being the beginning of that effort, the whole room adopted by acclamation.
Wow.
So that was kind of the culminating moment. And he had done a speech Saturday morning as well.
Right. I was there for
that. Right, for that.
Yeah.
I think you could tell he's wrestling with this question of, you know, independent or Democrat.
Yeah, we talked about it on our program last Friday, too. Actually, he didn't talk about wrestling with that issue. He talked about wrestling with whether he should run at all.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing he's waiting to see who else emerges. And typically, you know, people don't declare their candidacy for president until the spring of the year before the election, which would be, you know, after this Christmas, it would be, you know, next spring. Although all bets are off given the way that the Koch brothers are messing with our political system. And after Citizens United, I mean, it's like everything has gone nuts.
Exactly.
In politics in America. So people can still support Progressive Democrats of America by going over to pdamerica.org. They can create a local chapter.
The best way to get involved in PDA is through these issue organizing teams. I was on a call on Sunday where we had nearly 100 people planning and learning about the TPP trade agreement and opposing fast
SHAFTA,
track.
SHAFTA, I call it.
SHAFTA, that's very good.
Yes, Southern Hemisphere Asian free trade agreement.
Right, Shafta. Yeah. Shaft them, Shafta us.
Yeah. We got an after Shafta. Shafta.
And there's also issue organizing teams on, you know, the military, ending the war, and single-payer healthcare reform, you know, healthcare, not warfare. So those are really the best vehicles, because that combines the educate Congress work with the grassroots organizing, the movement building piece. And Connor Boylan and Andrea Miller are serving as co-executive directors and carrying on Tim's work. And we're continuing to be active around the country in some electoral races.
So people can get over to pdamerica.org. You and I are going to be at a fundraiser in California and Los Angeles in June.
That's right.
We'll talk more about that later.
That's
Michael Lighty. Great to see you, Michael.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's pdamerica.org. Check it out. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Morris, listening to KPFK in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, you wanted to talk about Credit Suisse. You know, I never got to that today. And that really has been sticking in my craw, too. I can guess what you're going to say, but go for it.
Professor, come on now. $2.6 billion, that should have been a $250 billion settlement. Listen, these guys don't deal with millions of dollars. They're not broke like us. These guys deal with trillions of dollars. This was an embarrassment. And if you do the breakdown on the money, they gave $715 million to the New York State Department of Financial Services. They gave $100 million to the Federal Reserve, but that's not the big deal. The big deal here, and I'm with the senator, I think his name is, I'll think of it before I leave, Carl Levin from Michigan. Mm-hmm. There are 20,000 names on that list. They didn't have to give up the list. Who's on the list?
Right.
That's
right.
What we want. And then, and Mr. Holder's talking about we're going to prosecute to the full extent of the law. I didn't see that. These guys were convicted of a criminal conspiracy to evade paying U.S. taxes. Please give me a break.
And nobody went to jail. The only bankster so far who has gone to jail was the American who was working inside one of the Swiss banks, and it might have been Credit Suisse. I don't recall which one. He was working in Switzerland in one of the Swiss banks and notified the federal government. He was a whistleblower, notified the federal government that they were helping hide taxes for Americans. He is now sitting in a federal prison for having violated the banking secrecy
law. That's wrong. That's wrong. And let me tell you, they're not even thinking of their own people. They could have broke down and gave some of that money to state attorney generals, for example. Kamala Harris, she was stuck with Angelo Mozilla from Countrywide.
Yeah.
Folks, when this thing first went down with Countrywide had assets of $104 billion. They were number one in the world, okay? In California, produced 20% of all of your foreclosures in the United States. So I saw she had to take $6.5 million as a settlement from him. And first I got a little upset with that, but I understood why she did it, because I could see Mrs. Harris's attorneys, two of those guys, $100,000 men.
Yeah.
And Mr. Mozilla's got five of them, million-dollar men.
Yeah.
And it would have been like when that Maxwell Valdez, and we would have gone off for decades. So they took the money. But this is wrong. Now, I'm going to tell you, let me ask you a question, Professor. If somebody had that list of 20,000 people, would that list be worth $50 million to somebody?
Yeah.
All right. All right. Thank you, sir. I'll give it to you later.
Well, let me add to this, Boris. I am of the opinion that Credit Suisse not only should have had to pay a huge fine, and that fine, A, the people are entitled not only to know who those 10,000 people were who co-conspired with them to violate federal laws, because if you, there are average working people who are in jail for refusing to pay their taxes or screwing up on their taxes, right? So there's, you got 10,000 Americans who co-conspired with a Swiss bank to avoid paying taxes. They should be being prosecuted. They should be doing perp walks, number one. And number two, Credit Suisse should lose its license, its right, its ability, its privilege to conduct business in the United States. They should have to close their U.S. offices.
Now, Professor, let's get real about this. What if I told you, well, now we know that about the 400 people that own a whole lot of wealth, what if I told you that a whole lot of people in Congress, that their names are on there? What if I told you that some folks in the White House, that their names are on there?
I'd be surprised.
What if I told you some people in the criminal justice system, that their names are on there?
I'd be surprised. I would be real surprised if it wasn't anything other than the captains of industry in America. But you never know, Morris. You never know. I mean, there are some rich people in Congress. They don't call the Senate the Millionaires Club for nothing. Morris, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to KPFK. It's always great to hear from you and any KPFK listeners. We'll be right back 20 minutes past the hour. Sarah Palin and the death panels. Well, turns out the death panels are real, and we found them. Seriously. Back in 2009, when the healthcare debate was at its most crazy, Republicans warned us that once Obamacare was passed, government officials would get to ration health care and as a result have control over the life and death of millions of Americans. And they called the bureaucrats who supposedly got to make these decisions death panels. The idea of death panels had actually been kind of swirling around the right-wing media echo chamber for a while, but it really kind of jumped the shark into the mainstream when Sarah Palin talked about it in an August 2009 Facebook note that got picked up by the national press. Palin said that if the health care bill became law, Obamacare, people like her disabled son, she's got a kid with Down syndrome, her disabled son would, quote, have to stand in front of Obama's death panel so his bureaucrats could decide based on a subjective judgment of their level of productivity in society whether they are worthy of health care, end of quote. Soon everyone, pundits, politicians, they were all talking about death panels. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, for example, back on August 11th, 2009, he stood up in front of a crowd of supporters and says, "Our version of the health care bill would allow government to decide when to pull a plug on grandma." Grassley's warning about a grandmother-killing socialist plan was one of a whole bunch of these, you know, scare stories told by Republicans that summer. Be afraid, be very afraid. It's really, you know, now we look back in retrospect, it's really easy to laugh at Chuck Grassley and Sarah Palin now that more than 8 million Americans are getting health insurance because of Obamacare and people's lives are actually being saved by Obamacare. But the ironic thing is that people like Sarah Palin and Chuck Grassley, who warned us about death panels, were actually kind of right. All across the country right now, people are literally dying because politicians are denying them the health care they need to survive, and it does have something to do with Obamacare. But it's not because President Obama or some evil communist plot that puts politics over lives got hatched. It's because of Republicans. Republicans have created their own death panel. Activists connected to MoveOn.org showed up at the largest of these GOP death panels in New York City yesterday. It's called the Republican Governors Association. Its president is Chris Christie. And its members, people like Nikki Haley and Rick Perry, they're the real healthcare killers. That's because right now, 24 states, all of which are either led by Republican governors or controlled by Republican legislatures, are refusing to expand Medicaid under Obamacare. And as a direct result of that, approximately 4.8 million, almost 5 million low-income working Americans do not have health insurance just because Republican governors and legislators in red states refuse to take the federal money that would pay for it. These 4.8 million people work at low-paying jobs, typically earning between $4,000 and $11,000 a year. But even at that, they make too much money to qualify for the normal non-expanded Medicaid, and they're too poor to qualify for the free or subsidized health insurance on the Obamacare exchanges. They're caught in what's known as the red state donut hole, which was drilled into Obamacare by John Roberts and the other four right-wing justices on the Supreme Court when they said that states could refuse money to expand Medicaid. The death panels that Sarah Palin went on and on about for years, back 4 years ago, they are real, not real. But the red state donut hole death panel actually is real and actually is killing people. Back in March, for example, Charlene Dill, a hardworking single mom who worked three jobs to help make ends meet, collapsed and died from an untreated heart condition. Like approximately 750,000 other Floridians stuck in the red state donut hole, Charlene knew she was sick and needed medication, but couldn't get it to save her life because Florida's Republican Governor Rick Scott refused to expand Medicaid under Obamacare. Rick Scott now has Charlene's blood on his hands. And Charlene isn't the only person killed by the Red State Donut Hole death panel, and she certainly won't be the last. In fact, according to a new study out of Harvard University, as many as 17,000 people will die in America just this year as a direct result of the Republican Party's refusal to expand Medicaid. These Republicans should rot in hell, and probably will. By saying no to expanded Medicaid, they have said no to the right of life of the people who put them into office. And make no mistake about it, this is all about politics. Republican governors like Rick Perry say they're worried about the cost of Medicaid expansion. But since that expansion would be covered almost entirely by the federal government, they're just flat out lying. This is all about one thing and one thing alone: sabotaging the Obama presidency. As the midterm elections inch closer and closer, it's going to be harder and harder for Republicans to explain to voters why they've decided to sacrifice the health care of 4.8 million Americans just to make Obama look bad. Which is why right now is the time to call out the Republican refusal to expand Medicaid under Obamacare for what it is: GOP death panel. And it's why it's so cool that MoveOn.org showed up with a giant truck right out in front of the Republican Governors Association on the truck and said, "We found the death panel. It's right here, Republican Governors Association." I mean, after all, if the myth of Obamacare death panels was enough to change public opinion back in 2009, and it did for a lot of people, who knows what the truth about the Republican death panels could do, especially in an election year like this. I mean, we got an election coming up in November. So now you know death panels are real. They are called Republican governors, Republican legislatures. They're functioning in 24 states. They have decided if you are truly poor, you qualify for Medicaid. If you're middle class or wealthy, no problem. You get Obamacare or private health insurance. But if you're the working poor, if you make over $4,000 and less than $11,000 a year, you're toast. You get nothing. You get to show up at the ER when you're bleeding out, and that's it. Thank you, Republicans. This is a crime. You know, it's a moral crime.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Charlene Dill's name should be mentioned every day in Congress. Charlene Dill, who Rick Scott killed. Well, a lot going on in the world. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, kids. Nancy Pelosi has picked five people for the Benghazi Select Committee on conspiracy hoo-hoo. Unfortunately, none of them, the bad news is none of them are Alan Grayson. I don't want to speculate about her motives or his motives, but he might just be a little more aggressive than the official Democratic Party wants to have out there. But she did what she did do is she picked a group of five Democrats who are pretty damn strong people. And you have the list? Okay, they are. Elijah Cummings. And Elijah Cummings knows how to take names and kick ass, number one. Adam Schiff. Adam Schiff had earlier come out and said, we shouldn't even play with these guys. I mean, he knows how to call out Republicans. Adam Smith. I don't know that much about Adam Smith. Which Sanchez is it? Linda Sanchez? Oh, Linda Sanchez. She knows how to do media. She's on CNN all the time. And Tammy Duckworth. I mean, talk about somebody who really knows how to, you know, Tammy's good. She's really good. So here, thank you, Shano. So we've got this great list of people, and this is cool. Obama says he's going to have a forceful response to the scandal at the VA. You know, it's like, you know, the stuff at the VA is like, yes, of course, it requires a forceful response. But it really is, again, being used by the Republicans and by Fox News to trash the idea that government can run a health care system. Pennsylvania's Governor Tom Corbett has come out and said, you know, there's a federal judge. Was it yesterday or today? I am so time dysfunctional. I guess it was yesterday. Federal judge said gay marriage is unconstitutional in Pennsylvania, overturned that, and Tom Corbett just came out and said, he's the governor, came out and said, I'm not going to dispute this. So gay marriage stands, as of now, in Pennsylvania forever. That's it. So, you know, some interesting things going on. And the U.S. military has just deployed actual soldiers to help search for these missing Nigerian girls that Boko Haram has taken. which could be a really great move or a huge mistake. I don't honestly know. I'm not well versed in those kind of things. I was listening to BBC about this last night, and they had on a couple of people who are not Americans discussing a couple of Africans and a couple of Europeans. And the consensus seemed to be that we should simply pay them a ransom, get the girls back, and then nuke them back to the Stone Age, you know, then go in. But they were all, these Europeans were saying on BBC, if my recollection of I was listening to this as I was falling asleep, of the podcast was correct, was that essentially they were concerned that America has this macho, you know, we got to do everything with a fist, right? We don't pay no stinking terrorists. We don't negotiate with no stinking terrorists. And so rather than paying the ransom and getting the girls and then going in and finding these guys and you know, taking them out, that we would just try to go in and take them out and that they would probably kill the girls. And so we'll see how this plays out. But that's the news. That's what is being reported by the New York Times right now, is that that the Obama administration has said, yep, we're going to send some soldiers over there. Sharon in Bellingham, Washington, listening on KBAI. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Hi there. I am going to, Governor Inslee has a cap and trade thing going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And so if anyone in Bellingham doesn't know about it, tonight at the Crowley Courthouse, there is a debate at, 6:30, doors open at 6, with Senator Erickson, who's a Republican, Daniel Simmons, who is Institute for Energy Research, which is Freedom Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Yuck. Anyway. And Joe Fitzgibbon, chair of the House Environment Committee, he's a Democrat, and Dr. Yoram Bauman, who is at the University of Washington, he's the environmental economist there and also a stand-up comedian.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm wondering is, when I go there, you were talking about an option to cap and trade, and quite frankly, I don't remember it. It had something to do with rebates like the oil thing in Alaska, and I just wanted some information to take with me.
Sure. They're really two separate things. There's cap and trade, and there's fee and rebate. And fee and rebate is also often referred to as carbon tax, and it doesn't always involve a rebate. There's variations on that. The way cap and trade works is, let's say that all of industry in the state of Washington is emitting a million tons of CO2 right now. I mean, I have no idea what the number is, but let's just take that for example. So what you do is you say, okay, we're going to cap it at a million tons right now. It can't go any higher than that. Next year, we're going to drop that cap down to 800,000, 900,000 tons. The year after that, it'll be 800,000 tons. Those industries that don't use carbon can sell their right to emit carbon to those industries that use more than their right is granted to them. Because basically what you do is you take all the industry in the state and you divide up the carbon that's produced in the state and you say, okay, here's your allotment. And you've got some companies that don't produce any and you've got some companies that produce way too much. And so so they end up trading these carbon options and a price gets established for them. And over time, as a number of options that are out there, the cap declines, the number of options that can be traded declines, their value goes up. And as their value goes up, it becomes more and more expensive to pollute, to buy the option to pollute. And that eventually hits a tipping point where companies say, okay, we're just not going to produce this kind of pollution anymore, rather than pay the fee. And that's how George Herbert Walker Bush did it with sulfur dioxide and to stop acid rain. And it was quite successful over a 5 or 6 year period. It's how the Europeans did it with sulfur dioxide back in the 80s as well. And it's how Europeans have been doing it with carbon dioxide now for about a decade. In Europe, however, they didn't decline the cap anywhere near fast enough. And so it's become basically a scam where the banksters are, setting up stock exchanges to trade the carbon credits, and everybody's making money on it, and it's really not cutting carbon emissions. So you got to worry about that. You got to, it's got to be correctly constructed if you're going to do cap and trade. Now, the fee and rebate system is where you say, okay, if you're going to emit carbon, there's a simple price for that, and the price will go up over time. But let's say it starts out at $25 a ton for carbon emitted. And 100% of that money that we collect from you, and then next year it'll be $30, and the year after that it'll be $35, And you can call that a carbon tax. You can call it a carbon fee. The fee is much more palatable politically. And 100% of that fee that comes into the government. Now, in some countries, like in Denmark, for example, they use that fee to pay for their healthcare system. But what I'm suggesting, and what a lot of people in the anti-carbon movement or the Save the Planet movement here in the United States are suggesting, is that 100% of that fee be rebated to the average American. So you would say in the state of Washington, let's say the state of Washington generates $1 million from carbon taxes, carbon fees next year. They then say, okay, how many people do we have in the state? I don't know what the population of Washington State is. What is it, around 3-4? No, it's got to be 7-8 million. Let's say it's 10 million people, just to make even numbers. If you make $1 million, you got 10 million people. Everybody in the country gets, what would that be, $10? No, it'd be the other way around. Everybody in the country gets 10 cents. That's not so much, but let's say they've made $100 million. Everybody in the country gets $10. Or in the state rather, and it goes up over time, because in Alaska right now, as a result of the fees that the state of Alaska charges the oil companies for drilling and transporting oil in Alaska, they actually put that money into what's called the Alaska Permanent Fund. They invested it in like a pension, and every year they just pull $2,000 for every single, roughly, it varies from year to year, but it's whatever the interest payments are from the fund. They pull that amount out, and they pay it out to every man, woman, and child in Alaska. So Sarah Palin has five kids. She and Todd are a family of seven, as I recall. And so she would get $14,000, you know, seven times 2,000. And so that way you get around the objection to the carbon tax making gasoline more expensive by saying, yes, it's going to make gasoline more expensive, but you're going to get, you know, $100 a year, you're going to get $1,000 a year, whatever. You're going to get, you know, money back from this. And it would actually generate far more than a million. It might generate $1 billion, actually, you know, a $25 tax per ton of carbon emitted. So if it generates $1 billion and you've got 10 million citizens, everybody's getting $1,000, if I'm doing my math right, maybe 10,000. I don't know. I can't do math in my head like that. But do you understand the distinction, Sharon?
Yeah, I do. And I'm just wondering, though, you said that in Europe they're able to scam it, and is it on the cap and trade,
yes,
is this fee and rebate less likely to get scammed?
Yes. It all depends. The fee and rebate is both of them, the success of them depends on over time raising the cost of carbon and doing it rapidly enough. And in the problem in Europe is that they put this thing into place back a decade ago when everybody figured the problem wasn't going to hit us until 2100. You know, the IPCC is being very conservative and all that kind of stuff. And so they said, oh, we'll phase it in over 30 years. And so the first 10 years was like, we'll work the bugs out of it. Well, you know, now they've got this system that's already in place and already has vested interests and already has banksters making money off it. And there's a lot of momentum not to make it more aggressive. And we want not to make that mistake if we're going to do cap and trade. So you want the price of carbon to go up or the cap to go down. They are essentially the same thing. The cap going down is what drives up the price. You want it to happen at a fairly rapid pace over a period of, you know, 10 or 15 years rather than over a period of 30 or 40 years like they did in Europe. Make sense?
Yeah, thank
okay.
you so much,
Sharon,
for the information.
Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. And I'm sorry. We've got more time. We got another 15 minutes. We'll be right back with more of your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's been a long day. For some reason, I thought I'd hit the end of the show. Anyhow, we'll be back with more of your calls right after this. Stick around. Tom Hartman. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Michelle, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Michelle, you wanted to talk about the MERS virus?
Hi, Tom. I have not heard this brought up anywhere. I've looked for resources. This year's upcoming Hajj during Ramadan.
Yeah.
In Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
The source of, apparently one of the sources of MERS.
Right.
If you're talking potential global epidemic, is anybody looking into how this may play out? I mean, thousands of people from all over the globe, from first world nations to developing nations visit, and have you seen anything where anybody is being proactive?
I guarantee you, the Saudi government and the CDC and organizations within the American government are hysterical about this. Michelle, for people who don't know what we're talking about, in Islam there is a teaching, and I don't know if it's literally part of the Quran or if it's one of the interpretations, but there's a teaching that if you do not visit Mecca at least once in your life, then and in the Hajj, they actually, you go into this sacred place in Mecca and throw a, pick up a pebble and throw it at this giant piece of rock,
Kaaba,
which represents the devil.
The Kaaba.
The Kaaba, it's called? Okay, thank you.
The big black box, the
yeah,
Kaaba.
Yeah, okay. And you throw a stone at the devil, basically, and then you're ensured that when you die, you actually will go to heaven. And so Muslims from all over the world every year, literally millions and millions of them, go not just to Saudi Arabia, not just to Mecca, but to this one particular spot.
Right.
Where they're all breathing and sneezing on each other. And MERS virus is a coronavirus. Coronaviruses are the same family as the common cold and as SARS. It has apparently, and these coronaviruses start in animals. SARS started in a type of cat that had rarely ever been human food, but apparently people in China started eating them, and it was a wild cat. And it jumped into a human from a cat that was infected with it. And then that human, it mutated in the human in such a way that he could then infect other humans. And apparently the exact same thing has happened in Saudi Arabia with a virus that, with a coronavirus that camels have, and that is a coronavirus, a common cold family virus. As somebody was eating camel meat or got a camel sneezed on them or got camel snot in their body somehow, and not just somebody, several people, and it mutated in that person, in one of those persons, to become infectious from person to person, and it is now a human virus. And we call this MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. SARS was Southeast Asian, I believe, respiratory syndrome. And it's 30% of the time deadly. And there have now been three cases diagnosed in the United States, and I believe two of them were person-to-person transmission in the U.S. by somebody who came here from Saudi Arabia. And it appears to be the Saudi Arabian camels that were the original vector for this thing, and everybody is freaked out about it. And when the Hajj happens, when is the Hajj scheduled to happen?
I believe Ramadan, according to the calendar that I have, begins June 29th. So we've only got a few short weeks. And,
yeah.
And like I said, I haven't seen or heard anything World Health Organization or... Yeah, I've seen some airports are putting up notices, but...
Yeah. Well, you've got to get a visa to get into Saudi Arabia from most countries, so it may be that they'll down-regulate people in a more quiet way that way. I just don't know. Like yourself, I haven't seen anything. I guarantee you, though, they're freaked out about this thing. Michelle, thank you for the call. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Michelle just called and pointed out that the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, MERS, this new coronavirus, it's like a common cold virus that jumped out of camels into humans in Saudi Arabia and now has infected three people in the United States at 30% fatality rate. That what are they going to do? Ramadan is coming up at the end of June. And every Muslim must go to Mecca at least once during their life and throw a stone at the devil in order to make it to heaven. And, what's Saudi Arabia going to do, with this very real possibility of a worldwide epidemic of a contagious disease that has a 30% mortality rate? And she asked the question. I didn't have an answer. But as usual, our listeners are smarter than I am. Paul, watching Free Speech TV in Lucerne, California. You apparently saw a story about this on Al Jazeera?
Yeah, I saw it. It was either last night or the night before. I don't really remember exactly when, but they're actually going to make an announcement next week whether they're going to let this happen, Ramadan happen or not. They're talking to the clerics right now. The government is seriously pushing not to let it happen, but the religious community is pushing for it to happen.
The government of Saudi Arabia. So the royal family doesn't want it happening. I'm sure they're not real excited about the idea of even themselves getting sick,
this is seriously dangerous, and they're taking their health officials seriously.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but the religious guys are in favor of that. That's really interesting. And I'm guessing that there's lots of pressure from nearby countries and that it's going to break into these two factions of, you know, is it public health or is it religion?
Well, the news story was saying that there's lots of pressure on both sides.
Yeah.
To stop it and to have it. I mean, it's a big deal.
Well, if they have it, the mosques make a fortune. I mean, you know, all these tourist dollars and everything. I mean, it's not just a religious thing. It's an industry as well.
And it's also people get together every year to see people. It's a cultural thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and then probably, yeah, absolutely.
That part.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a celebration thing.
Yeah, yeah. It would be like canceling Christmas in the United States. No, you can't go visit your family for Christmas because you might carry something contagious because, you know.
Exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Paul, thank you very much for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Jerry in Long Island listening on WBAI. Hey, Jerry, what's up? WBAI is having a fundraiser right now, by the way. Give him a shout if you can. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah. Yeah, how you doing, Tom? Yeah,
good.
I'd like to discuss what you were discussing with your guest on Medicare for All single-payer system and how it actually saved money, actually saved the Medicare system. Yeah, but I do want to give a brief clarification to what's happening in Florida with Medicaid, because I have a brother and a sister-in-law and a nephew who's severely autistic, relies on Medicaid in Florida. And it's important to remember that Medicaid, as we know it, has been ended in Florida thanks to all the Republicans, not just the governor, the legislature as well. And Medicaid has been almost completely privatized in Florida, with Medicaid beneficiaries being pushed into private HMOs with public Medicaid money. So it's important to remember that
this is criminal.
Medicaid,
you know,
yeah, right.
It's a crime against democracy.
It is so, but it's important to remember that even if tomorrow the Republicans of Florida changed their mind and said they wanted to expand Medicaid, it would not be Medicaid as well. It would actually be private HMO plans, which, in my opinion, just make their money by overly restricting and denying access to much-needed medical care for cost too much money. But with respect to Medicare for All and how that would save money, I don't think many people know this, but right now Medicare by law does into the Medicare system only those people under the age of 65. It actually does accept some people under the age of 65, but only if they're too sick and disabled to work and receiving Social Security disability.
Right.
But also by law, Medicare excludes and is forbidden from including in the program young, healthy, 20-year-old, able-bodied Americans under the age of 65. And there's no private health insurance plan to work on that model. They do the opposite. They try to pick the healthiest people and put them in the insurance pool.
Right. Medicare does the opposite. And Medicare actually charges for its services. This is the other thing a lot of people don't realize until apparently they hit retirement age, is that you have to pay for Medicare. It's not free.
Yeah, it's last right. There is a premium.
It's cheap.
It's like only $1,000. Yeah, I think it's only $1,000 a year or something.
Yeah, it's in the neighborhood of what Canadians pay for their health insurance. I think the Canadians pay around $140 a month.
Right. So it's a lot less expensive than private health insurance. It's a lot less better, too. It's actual health care.
Right.
They never excluded people with pre-existing conditions. I mean, when my father were old enough to qualify for it, my mother had myasthenia gravis and other health problems. My father developed Parkinson's disease.
Well, that was that was how LBJ sold it to the Republicans in Congress, was that we're going to take this load off the for-profit companies, which will make them more profitable. We're going to dump it on the government. The Republicans said, okay, cool, we'll do that. Jerry, I got to run. We got a whole bunch of callers here. I want to get at least a couple more in. We only have 1 minute left in the show. Mark in Rockport, Texas. Hey, Mark, what's up? Mark? No Mark. Okay, David in Chicago. Hey, David.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for, not thank you, but I appreciate the fact that you mentioned Rick Scott's involvement with that woman's death, and there's a certain tragic irony, in a poignant tragic irony, in that he was the head of that big health insurance company, multimillionaire, and on top of it, he's in government now, using that power, and that woman dies. It's tragic.
Yeah. And he was, by the way, guilty of the largest Medicare fraud in the history of the United States. He was the CEO of the company that pled guilty to that crime, and then he ran for governor. Spent, what, $70 million of his own money? Some mind-boggling amount of money to get himself elected.
He should be in prison, not Siegelman.
Yeah, I'm with you. Free-don.org. He absolutely, Don Siegelman should not be in prison. And Rick Scott, well, I would leave that to a jury, but yeah, I think you could build a case for it. David, thank you for the call. That's it for our show today. Tomorrow, oh, we got a bunch of cool stuff coming up. The important thing, if you take away anything from this show, ever, any day, regardless of the time, it's important to be informed. It's more important to be active. Get out there to do something. Go to PDA.org or MoveToAmend.org or MoveOn.com or MoveOn.org, excuse me. DemocracyForAmerica.com, whatever it may be. Sign up. Show up. Tag your in. Participate. Occupy something. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.